KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The New Year Dragon Dance Parade to celebrate the Year of the Rat begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and ends at the Oregon Historical Society. Live afternoon performances and activities will begin at 1:30 p.m. Again, that's Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The parade begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and the activities and performances begin at 1:30 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. Information about the parade route, performers, and sponsors can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:01 a.m. and it's time for... Well, it's time to finish out the radio zine this week with Rising Up with Sonali. From, I believe that's from our sister station, KPFK, in Los Angeles, which is also 90.7 in that market. Dig it. Serendipity, my loves.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump continues this week as House impeachment managers roll out their arguments in front of senators. The opening arguments presented by Representatives Adam Schiff, Hakeem Jeffries, Gerald Nadler, and others summarized the damning evidence gathered during the House investigations into President Trump's conduct and replayed clips of witness testimonies recorded during House hearings. Representative Schiff, who leads the House impeachment managers team, cited Alexander Hamilton in his statements on Wednesday. He also warned Republican senators determined to protect Trump of the perils to our democracy.
Should the Congress just get over it? Should the American people just come to expect that our presidents will corruptly abuse their office to seek the help of a foreign power to cheat in our elections? Should we just get over it? Is that what we've come to? I hope and pray that the answer is no. We cannot allow a president to withhold military aid from an ally at war for illicit help in a re-election campaign. I hope that we don't have to just get over that. I hope that we just don't have to get accustomed to that.
That's Representative Adam Schiff on Wednesday, the first day of arguments from the House in the impeachment trial. Reports of a witness swap were swiftly shut down by Mr. Schiff. Republicans were rumored to be offering John Bolton's testimony in exchange for that of Hunter Biden. Schiff responded, "This isn't like some fantasy football trade. Trials aren't trades for witnesses." Hunter's father, former Vice President Joe Biden, also dismissed the idea, saying, "This is a constitutional issue. We're not going to turn it into a farce, into some kind of political theater." Meanwhile, President Trump, who is still in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum, broke yet another Twitter record, posting 142 times in a single day on Wednesday, mostly insults against Democrats over impeachment. White House impeachment managers on Wednesday focused on the specifics of Trump's withholding of U.S. military aid to Ukraine in exchange for political dirt on Biden, and the second day of arguments is centered on the president's abuse of power. The Washington Post explained that the House impeachment managers have used 7 hours and 17 minutes of their 24 hours of allotted presentation time, leaving more than 16 hours to be spread across Thursday and Friday. The president's own legal team will get time to defend him starting on Saturday. It's not yet decided if witnesses will be allowed to address the Senate, and there may be a possible debate and vote on the matter next Wednesday. Meanwhile, a new Reuters-Ipsos poll found that a bipartisan majority of Americans want to see new witnesses testify in the impeachment trial. The number of voters critical of Trump versus supportive has not changed very much. However, the opening of the Senate impeachment trial drew about 11 million viewers. That's about 2.5 million fewer than the number that tuned in for the start of the House impeachment inquiry last year. And Fox News's website just ran a surprising op-ed by senior judicial analyst Andrew Napolitano, making the case for Trump's removal. Judge Napolitano concluded that the removal of a president needs, quote, a demonstration of presidential commission of high crimes and misdemeanors, of which, in Trump's case, the evidence is ample and uncontradicted. In other news, the Trump administration this week formally rolled back Obama-era protections of wetlands and waterways in a giveaway to big agribusinesses, the fossil fuel industries, and of course, real estate and golf course developers like Trump himself. The president has boasted about protecting clean water standards, but has also repeatedly slammed his predecessor's regulatory achievements on the issue. The New York Times explained the new water rule will remove federal protections from more than half the nation's wetlands and hundreds of thousands of small waterways. That would, for the first time in decades, allow landowners and property developers to dump pollutants, such as pesticides and fertilizers, directly into many of those waterways and to destroy or fill in wetlands for construction projects. Trump's similar plan to worsen air quality standards by removing fuel efficiency requirements in cars has come under scrutiny this week. His own administration has analyzed the proposed Safer, Affordable, Fuel-Efficient, or SAFE vehicles rule and concluded that in the long term, such cars would be neither cheaper nor safer. Trump has also taken aim at desert lands in California, with the government this week announcing a plan to develop tens of thousands of acres of desert land for geothermal energy. Critics fear the proposal would gut desert ecological protections and also set off a new water war. A South Dakota bill attacking the rights of transgender people has passed its first major hurdle. The state's House State Affairs Committee passed a bill that would make it illegal for doctors to perform gender reassignment surgeries for transgender youth. The proposal is being closely watched by right-wing anti-trans and homophobic forces in other states, like South Carolina, Colorado, Florida, Oklahoma, and Missouri. Among the tactics that such forces are using is to make gender reassignment treatments equivalent to child abuse, criminalizing parents as well as doctors. ACLU advocate Chase Strangio said, "I cannot imagine what happens to transgender people if these criminal bans pass. I don't think we can possibly raise the alarm enough because people are going to die." As the wealthy and elite attendees of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, continue their discussions on the global economy, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has followed in Trump's footsteps in making patronizing statements about the teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg. When asked about her demand to divest from fossil fuel companies, the former hedge fund manager and investment banker said to reporters, "Is she the chief economist? Who is she? I'm confused." He added, "After she goes and studies economics in college, she can come back and explain that to us." Thunberg retorted on social media, "It doesn't take a college degree in economics to realize that our remaining 1.5 degree carbon budget and ongoing fossil fuel subsidies and investments don't add up." In other news, the deadly coronavirus strain that has so far killed at least 18 people is continuing to spread despite China's travel bans, with billions of trips around Lunar New Year potentially supercharging the spread of the disease. There is still no medical consensus on treatment. China has banned travel in at least 4 cities so far. The International Court of Justice has issued an injunction in a closely watched case over Myanmar's genocidal persecution of Rohingya Muslims. The ICJ rejected arguments made by Myanmar's civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi and ordered that the country must, quote, take all measures within its power to end its treatment of the persecuted minority. The New York Times explained that, quote, the decision is the first international court ruling against Myanmar over its military's brutal treatment of the Rohingya. While the court has no enforcement power, any member of the United Nations can request action from the Security Council based on its rulings, end of quote. The judge in the case has ordered Myanmar to issue a report within 4 months on the steps it has taken to ensure compliance and to continue to submit reports every 6 months, but critics worry that none of it is enforceable unless there is massive international pressure. And finally, in Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson appears to be getting his way, as the controversial Brexit bill that he's pushed for just received royal assent, as per the country's obscure monarchical rules. In just over a week, the United Kingdom will separate from the European Union, more than 3 years after voters narrowly approved a referendum rife with controversy. The British Parliament will now have to ratify the deal before the deadline of January 31st. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As a Senate impeachment trial against President Donald Trump continues this week, there's been wall-to-wall media coverage of the historic event, which is appropriate given that it's only the third time in the nation's entire history that senators are being asked to consider removing a president from office. But one media outlet stands out in its coverage, and that's, of course, the president's favorite, Fox News. Fox News has a symbiotic relationship with the current White House, and it has not only mocked the case for impeachment as harshly as possible and claimed the president's complete innocence, but it's also seen its own talking points reflected back by the president's legal defense team. My guest is Julie Milliken, Vice President of Media Matters for America. Welcome to the program, Julie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So in the lead up to this, we, I'm sure, have had many indicators of how the Senate impeachment trial would be covered looking back at how Fox News covered the House impeachment inquiry. All of the hearings, many of which were carried, you know, live by many television stations and radio stations around the country. So far, what has the Fox News coverage of the Senate impeachment trial been like? I know we're only, you know, a few days in.
Right. Well, it really depends on when you're watching it, because I can tell you that once the primetime hours hit, there is almost no coverage of the impeachments happening live. What Fox has tended to do is that, like CNN and MSNBC, they're airing the afternoon coverage. As you know, the trials has typically been beginning around 1 o'clock p.m. each afternoon this week. And what they'll do is they'll air some of this during the daytime hours. But once the 5 o'clock hour hits, something really interesting happens, and that's they switch. And they are alone in switching back to their regular programming. They will at times have a split screen up with the impeachment trial happening on one screen, but with no audio, and the hosts going about their regular business in the other screen. At the same time, they're apologizing when they have to even break in, apologizing to their viewers, saying, "I'm sorry, I have to make you listen to this." And they're also doing things like Sean Hannity on the first night of the hearings, for instance. He refused basically to cover it at all, the trial at all, and instead said that he wouldn't torture his viewers with that. They had a split screen up with the silent trial proceedings happening on one screen, and then on the other screen actually were scrolling a list of accomplishments that, you know, President Trump supposedly had during his administration so far. So it's been really interesting. They've been, you know, again, trying to downplay or just straight up ignore what's happening and not show their viewers and tell their viewers instead that they can listen to the Fox summary of it. That's all they really need to hear.
How have they been covering Representative Adam Schiff? He is the leader of the House impeachment manager's team. He has been giving very forceful testimony. He was also the face of the impeachment alongside Nancy Pelosi as before the Senate impeachment trial began. And of course, Trump has been mocking him mercilessly, he calls him Shifty Shift. They've tried to create some story of a collusion between the original whistleblower who sparked the impeachment and Schiff. But in this instance, as Schiff has been giving, you know, laying out the House case for impeachment, what has Fox News been saying about him?
They've been just straight up insulting him. They've been following Trump's lead and going straight down that path of insulting him. Tucker Carlson last night was claiming things like he had a source that said he had no friends in high school. You know, they pick up on the pencil neck Schiff insult that Trump and other Republicans and right-wing talkers like to use. They've been calling him essentially, you know, a boring loser who has no friends, who nobody should be listening to, you know, talking about his appearance, talking about you know, you name it. So it's just been childish insults, middle school level taunts that are coming from Fox News, also coming from the president himself, of course. And once again, it's all because there's no defense. They have no defense for Trump's actions. He's clearly caught red-handed, you know, engaging in bad behavior and egregious abuses of power in his office. It's documented as well as anything could have possibly be documented. And since they have no excuse, they're just going to resort to finger pointing, name calling, and telling everybody, you know, that you shouldn't be paying attention to the case that's actually being made against the president.
So let's talk about the Trump legal defense team, whose opening arguments will be coming starting on Saturday. But we got a preview of them in the debate around the Senate impeachment trial rules earlier this week. It seems as though the only defense that they seem to have is, even if Trump did all of these things that you claim he did, so what? And this was echoed, I understand, on Fox News. I want to play a clip that Media Matters also showcased on your website of Reince Priebus, a, of course, prominent Republican who is very popular on Fox News as a guest. And this is what Priebus had to say on a panel on Fox News.
I think the senators, Republicans, have the stomach for it. Reince, that's sad. That bothers me.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And guess what? Sometimes the best defense is the so what defense, which is if everything the Democrats said is true, it's still not impeachable. If everything Les Parnas has said is true, it's still not impeachable. I mean, that's what this
great
is
point.
About.
It's a great point.
And that is Sean Hannity speaking with Reince Priebus on a panel, congratulating him on such a great point that Priebus came up with, which is, so what? Julie, is this something that you've seen being echoed on Fox News?
Oh, of course. What we've seen across Fox News since the beginning, since the whistleblower complaint first came out, is an evolution of excuses, but the core theme that's been consistent within them is, no matter what Trump did, he didn't do anything wrong. So it started with, oh, if he, you know, actually explicitly said there was a quid pro quo, then that would be bad. When it turned out he basically did exactly that, then it was like, well, that's not illegal. When the GAO found that he did, in fact, violate the law by withholding this funding, they said that that was just a process, you know, complaint, that wasn't actually something that anybody would actually hold a president to standard for. It wasn't an impeachable offense. It doesn't matter what it is. Their response is, so what? Trump is always right. It doesn't matter. There's no accountability. There's no holding him accountable. The answer is, so what?
And is this something that you expect from the legal defense team as well?
Oh, of course. And the other thing that we have seen, you know, the synergy that you mentioned with the legal team, with Trump's defense and with Fox News, at this point, it's almost indistinguishable between their talking points, the administration's talking points, the legal defense's talking points, and Fox News' talking points. So one of the other things that we saw this week in the opening arguments around the rules for the impeachment trial was Trump's legal team making a series of falsehoods that we had seen already being advanced on Fox News. So for instance, they claimed falsely that Republicans' House members were, left out of the SCIF, the secured area where they were doing interviews for witnesses initially in the House impeachment investigation. This is just categorically false. Republican members were allowed into the area to be part of the testimony. They made false claims that Republicans weren't allowed to call witnesses in the House trial, which is not true. Again, they had three witnesses that they were allowed to call. They just weren't allowed to call, say, Hunter Biden, for instance. They also, Sekulow echoed some false claims that we heard on Fox before, you know, this week's trial, in that he was claiming that the Mueller report, like, totally exonerated Trump on this issue of obstruction of justice. That is also not true. That was an immediate Fox spin coming out of the release of the Mueller report. However, that report very explicitly stated that there were at least 10 instances in which evidence showed that Trump, you know, could have been viewed as obstruction of justice, and they explicitly were not making a call on that matter due to longstanding Department of Justice guidelines around indictments of sitting presidents. And the examples just go on and on. We saw similar behavior during the House impeachment hearings when the witness testimonies were happening. We saw White House talking point memos being leaked into the press. We were able to match the talking points, specifically attacks on Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, that were in the White House memos with Fox News, just adopting them and passing them off as their own reporting and own talking points throughout the day that day during his testimony. It's just been a constant from the start of the Trump administration, but like in particular, Fox News jumping in to serve as the defense apparatus for the president and work closely with and sound exactly like Trump himself.
Have there been any dissenters on Fox News's panels or actually on the shows? We know that, for example, on their website this week, they did publish an op-ed by their senior judicial analyst, Andrew Napolitano, who in the headline, you couldn't quite tell. The headline was, "What does it take to remove a president?" The conclusion was very, very clear that essentially their evidence is ample and uncontradicted that Trump was guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. And, you know, essentially he concluded Trump should be removed from office. I don't know how often Napolitano is appearing on any of the analysis of the impeachment that Fox is doing when it actually does any analysis.
Yeah, so Napolitano is actually a really interesting case because he is one of the few voices on Fox that has been critical of Trump around the impeachment and thinks that he has committed impeachable offenses. For that opinion, he's been largely sidelined. So you'll see him, at FoxNews.com columns. Occasionally, he'll be on daytime, dayside programming around the impeachment where he's offering that opinion. He's never on primetime. But they very much have put him on the back burner and regulating him also to like Fox Nation, for instance, their streaming service that nobody watches. So they have a few dissenting voices, but they've been pushed off to the side. Napolitano is also somebody who is at the center of the dispute between Shepard Smith and Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson directly attacked Napolitano and Shep Smith for hosting Napolitano. This was during the House impeachment investigation, where Napolitano was, you know, making the case that Trump had committed impeachable offenses, and the evidence was showing exactly that. Shep Smith defended Napolitano. Tucker Carlson attacked him. The network ended up taking Tucker Carlson's side, and then Shep Smith ultimately resigned from the network. So what you're seeing is the rare cases that people do speak out. The rest of the network is in overdrive to try to drown them out.
Wow. How critically important is the fact that Fox News is also just simply not covering this very much? Because one of the things that House impeachment managers are relying on as they make their opening arguments is for the American public to have all of the evidence summarized clearly. They're playing back witness recordings of witness hearings, since it's not clear if there will be any live testimonies. They are, you know, in a way, we're sort of seeing the sort of TV courtroom type argument being laid out, and some of it makes for pretty compelling hearings. Some of it gets a little bit boring, but a lot of it is quite compelling. But Fox News is cutting away, you said.
Yeah. And it's by design. If you watch the analysis that's happening on other cable news networks, when they go on breaks from the trial or when the trial recesses for the evening, they have legal analysts coming on talking about how compelling of a case that the House Democrats are making, how strong their evidence is, how, you know, if this is not rising to the level of something that would be impeachable to remove a president, what actually would? Because the case is so solid. And Fox is deliberately keeping that away from their audience. They have to, because if their audience saw what evidence actually did existed that was not tainted by the Fox News lens, the Fox News filter, and the Fox News spin that they're putting on it, they would see that they're being lied to. They're being lied to by the president. They're being lied to by the Republicans. They're being lied to by their media outlets that they choose to get their information from. And so in order to keep up the charade, they have to make sure not to show it to their viewers.
Does Fox News's impact, or does Fox News's approach have an impact? There are, of course, millions of Americans tuning in. There was one report that showed 11 million Americans have tuned in for the opening arguments of the Senate impeachment trial. There were about 13.5 million or 13.8 million that tuned in for the House impeachment hearings. I imagine that because of Fox News's pretty striking spin, we might see a striking difference in opinion among viewers.
Yes, and that is exactly being shown through polling. So basically, Fox's approach is holding the base, and that is what's happening. The people who are, Fox News viewers overwhelmingly view the impeachment investigation as illegitimate, as a attempted coup against the president, as an attempt to undo the 2016 election results. All of the things that the White House and Fox News want you to believe, they firmly believe, and that's being laid out in the polling. And as such, that's, in my opinion, why you don't really see a massive change in Trump's overall approval rating, that he's holding the base, and that's what Fox is there for, to make sure that that base is held.
And so interesting, because during the House impeachment manager's opening arguments, the legal defense team, Trump's defense team, has to be silent, and so do senators, where the Republicans hold the majority. But Fox News is, of course, talking to the base, not inside the Senate room, not inside where the Senate impeachment trial is being held, but on television. And that is important, right? Because they seem to be doing the work of the legal defense team in lieu of the legal defense team while the impeachment manager's opening arguments are being read.
Yep, they're actually hosting the legal defense team as well. So we've seen...
They're hosting them as guests, yeah.
Yes, as guests. And so they've been coming on to present their case unfiltered, so they don't have to actually hear the evidence against them that's being presented by the House Democrats. And also, interestingly, are interviewing Senate Republicans while the trial is happening. So, for instance, Senator Hawley popped out of the trial to go do an interview with Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson even said at the beginning of the interview that he was, leaving the trial to do this interview. Now Hawley realized that was a violation of House rules, and I think went on Twitter to spin and say that he did this as a taped appearance during a break. But even still, instead of airing the trial live, they're hosting Republican senators, or hosting members of the Trump legal defense team, House Republicans that are part of the Trump's defense team, and also just are ardent supporters of the president, so that they can continue to present their alternate reality of Trump's actions and the impeachment investigation.
Going back to the arguments that we have already seen and expect to see from the legal defense team about, even if he did all of these things, so what? Do you think that, has Fox News also trotted out the argument that Trump likes to trot out, which is this is the Democrats' attempt to skew the 2020 election because they don't think they can actually win at the ballot box, of course, completely ignoring the fact that the impeachment is centered on an election interference attempt by the president.
Right. What they tend to do on Fox is take the 2020 lens and apply it towards Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. And
so
what they
deflecting.
Say, really, yeah, deflecting and pointing to the conspiracy theory that they've been trying to advance from the beginning, and saying, no, this is really all just a distraction from the corruption that the Democrats are engaging in. Look at this, look at that. It's a classic whataboutism technique that the network is like wholeheartedly engaging in and has been from the start.
Wow. And of course, there was some bizarre talk at the trial itself there were rumors that there was a talk of a witness swap.
Right.
It sounded like a prisoner swap where the Republicans were actually suggesting that Bolton could testify if Hunter Biden could, and the Democrats sort of swatted that away, it seems rightly so. And so I'm wondering if just your own analysis of the impeachment trial itself, in watching these proceedings, how do you assess the fact that Republican senators swore an oath to do impartial justice, and they're very clearly already violating that?
Right. I think it's a joke, to be perfectly honest. The idea that there was ever going to be impartial justice when you have Mitch McConnell from the get-go openly acknowledging that he is going to be coordinating with the White House on how to proceed for the trial to make it as favorable as possible towards the president. I think it's wishful thinking on the part of some that there even may be anyone breaking from party lines to, you know, vote to hold the president accountable for his actions. It's a partisan charade, and it's really disappointing. And it's really a sad day, a sad week, a sad time for this country, because this is an assault on our democracy that is being allowed to happen. And the Senate Republicans are abdicating their responsibilities as a co-equal branch of the government and holding the executive branch accountable, because they're afraid of the base, and they're afraid of their own voters, and they're just more concerned about holding the majority.
And of course, in the next few days, the legal defense team will present their legal arguments in defense of the president. Like the House impeachment managers, they will have 24 hours spread out over 3 days if they wish to use all 3 days. Do you think Fox News is going to cut to wall-to-wall coverage at that point?
Probably, to be perfectly honest. First of all, I mean, just in fairness, they're going to most likely be starting on Saturday. So weekend programming, I could see them preempting that for the trial, especially when it's Trump's defense and their defense is coming straight from their network and it's aligned with the messaging that the network has been promoting. I also would personally be surprised if they take the full 24 hours and 3 days to present their defense. I don't know how many times they can say witch hunt and fake news and, you know, there's nothing to see here. This is all a coup, deep state coup, for 24 hours. I just don't see them having that ability to fill that space. So I would expect that there would be more coverage on Fox of the Trump team's legal defense, but we'll have to see how that plays out.
And I wonder if their talking point about this week's coverage, as the, you know, advising their viewers to not watch the impeachment trial because it's, quote, so boring, if that'll hold up when the defense team takes the microphones.
I'm sure that Jay Sekulow will just have the most riveting defense as far as they're concerned and make such a compelling case, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I can almost hear them saying it now.
Julie, where can people find out more about the work that Media Matters does? I imagine you have more analysis. You and your colleagues will be putting out more analysis in the coming days.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can visit us at our website. It's mediamatters.org. And we will have tons of analysis on what's happening with the media coverage of the impeachment trial and also other major issues that are happening through the day. So look forward to, you know, working with my team on that. And I hope you guys enjoy what we're doing.
And that's mediamatters.org. Julie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Julie Milliken. She's the Vice President of Media Matters for America. We've been discussing how Fox News is covering the Senate impeachment trial and also how Trump's legal defense team is echoing Fox News talking points. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Comedians, like their predecessors, the court jesters, are traditionally truth-tellers in our societies. They couch harsh truths within humor to soften the blow at those in power. But we've been told for years that men are the funny ones and that women just aren't funny. That's, of course, changing thanks to the pioneering work of feminist comedians of color like Margaret Cho or Wanda Sykes, who aren't just funny, they're engaging in subversive social commentary, analyzing the changing landscape of comedy and what it means for social justice issues today is a new book titled Uproarious, whose lead author is Cynthia Ouellette. She's the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Philosophy at Emory University. Her earlier books include Interspecies Ethics, Irony in the Age of Empire, Comic Perspectives on Freedom and Democracy. She now joins me to discuss her new book, co-written with Julie Ouellette, called Uproarious, How Feminists and Other Subversive Comics Speak Truth. Welcome to the program, Cynthia.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, of course, it's not new that women comedians have shattered the glass ceiling of comedy, if you will. There have been female comics for probably as long as there have been male comics. But what's different about today, especially in the United States today, where we do have access to social media and other channels, you know, ways in which female comedians, feminist comedians have been able to bypass the traditional gatekeeping?
Yeah, that's a very important point. And let me back up just a little bit to emphasize, in part because of the new social media, comedy itself, humor very generally has become an important political force in our culture. It drives a lot of our culture. It's almost the emotional engine for so much of our politics. So you might think of humor and ridicule today functioning something like music, soulful music, did during the 60s and the 70s as a real catalyst for social movements. So comedy has that important role. Now, when comedy really rose up to become a central force, it was largely in the hands of right-wing radio talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh, who would make fun of the feminazis. But something's changed, and you're right, it turns on the access through social media that feminists and others who have been marginalized now have access to a more public stage.
And of course, there are so many different kinds of comedy, and there's debate over what's considered okay within comedy and what's not. But by and large, it seems as though the kind of comedy that punches up versus punching down is where you can actually tell whether this is something that's in the service of social justice or this is preserving the status quo or in fact even amplifying power. The most famous comedian who perhaps coined that whole term of punching upwards is George Carlin. I'm quite partial to him because of his history with Pacifica Radio. Did a comic like Carlin, although he was a white man, change the landscape of American comedy?
He was very important in bringing forth comedy as a political force. Now, I will say that I'm not sure that he fully understood intersectionality. I'm not sure that a lot of the comics of that time period, Lenny Bruce and others, although important political forces, would understand, they'd understand some forms of power, but perhaps not all forms of power. So it really took everyone from even Roseanne Barr in the 80s, who modeled herself in part off of those comics, to the really rise of strong feminist comedians, Wanda Sykes, Tig Notaro, many others today, to really fully address the kinds of sources of power that women, for women, they've been quite visible sources of power and not always visible to others.
Right. We've had men of color, of course, Richard Pryor and Dick Gregory, who may have challenged racial injustice. It's not clear how much they necessarily challenged sexism, right, or patriarchy.
That's exactly right. So it wasn't clear that they understood all the different ways in which power worked, although they were very important in leading the way for understanding how humor could take on directly sources of power, and especially white supremacy in the United States, as well as its authoritarianism in the 60s with the war, the anti-war movement, pushing it back against that authoritarianism. So those comics are very important. They themselves had connections. They were often mentored by leaders of the Black Panthers, so there was a direct connection between Black activism and the Black comics in this country. And so the change is that now we see that humor has become much more central to feminist movements as well.
Let's actually step back and examine comedy in a more general term. You're a philosophy professor. How do you view the role of comedy in a society, whether it's a democracy or not? In some cases, comedy is even more important when you're not living in a democracy. But how do you view the role that comedy and comedians play? Is it so reductive as comparing them to the court jester of, you know, a different era?
Is it so? It's very appropriate to do that. Absolutely. You know, as a philosopher, I can't help but go back and think of Socrates, that first philosopher of Greece, ancient Greece, who was in many ways a stand-up. And what did he do with his humor, his irony, which is what he's known for? He directed it against the powers that be, and for that he was eventually sentenced to death. But he was a truth teller, and that's the real impulse behind both a lot of humor and philosophy. And that use of humor in particular to reveal truth has been especially potent. And if you think about it, it's because humor, unlike probably any other force, goes right to that existential core of who we are. For example, in one way, ridicule can strip us right bare and expose our vulnerability to even degradation, humiliation. It takes power from us. So humor can take power from us, expose the truth and expose lies, and it also can empower us.
Right. So when we talk about the way in which comedy has functioned, it can take power away from those who are both powerful, but also power away from those who are powerless. It's not naturally a force that is equalizing. I mean, I'm thinking of white performers performing in blackface for white audiences as comedy, reinforcing racism, punching down at disempowered peoples, right?
That's right. And so a lot of American humor began as minstrel humor, began supporting the white supremacy of the U.S. And so that was absolutely a punching down. And it was a punching down that was thought to be just in, well, good humor, that to be just entertaining, without the full force of it always being understood, without the full politics behind this seemingly innocent entertainment being understood. So it's very important for us to understand the politics behind what seems to be as innocent as an easy joke.
So let's talk about some of the comics today who you analyze in your book, the contemporary comics, and how they take their approach to comedy. What makes them subversive as opposed to protecting the status quo? I mean, you mentioned Tig Notaro and Wanda Sykes. You've also examined in your book women like Margaret Cho, and also male comics like Hari Kondabolu, who's an Indian American comic. Can you give me a sense of why their comedy fits within that same kind of truth-telling that societies need?
What they do is that they have really something of a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, they use humor very well for ridicule, to expose hypocrisies in our culture, to expose hidden forms of racism. But on the other hand, they do something more than that. If they just did that, that would be in itself worthwhile. I mean, that's something that is essentially akin to, it's akin to preaching to the choir. You embolden those or strengthen those who are subject to racist forces, to misogynist forces, by ridiculing the stereotypes that have been degrading, that have been exclusionary in our society. But I say there's a double-edged sword there, because it's interesting too how they often will use aspects of what we call having a sense of humor, of poking fun at themselves as well. And what this does is it makes them relatable. Mm-hmm. It makes it easy to laugh with them at the same time that we laugh at various stereotypes, various social norms that we may have not have questioned before. So what they've done with their humor is that they've opened us up to more fluid identities, so that we can find ourselves perhaps laughing, perhaps when we listen to comics who are mocking Islamophobia, for example, we might as whites find ourselves sitting side by side with persons of color laughing together. And that's important. That's a very important social force.
So when you say that they have a you know, a double-edged sort of approach to comedy, do you mean that say a woman like Margaret Cho can make fun of other Koreans because she's a Korean American comic and other women, but when she does it, she has the right to, because she identifies with that social demographic, that ethnic and gender demographic. And that may be something that opens her up to people, and her humor up to people might not otherwise, you know, want to take her seriously.
Yes, but it's very important to make several distinctions, two big ones here. And one of them is that even as she exhibits a sense of humor about herself, mocking herself, that she is not playing on the old stereotypes in a way to reinforce them, that she's not engaging in what Hannah Gadsby calls that humor of self-humiliation. It's one thing to use humor to open yourself up, to show your vulnerable points. It's another to walk right into that trap of a self-humiliating humor that puts you back into the misogynistic culture, for example.
Right. I mean, I don't mind watching women make fun of things that women do, but I have a big problem with men engaging in sexist stereotypes. And the same with, you know, if an Indian comic makes fun of other Indians in a way that I can relate to, that to me could be funny, but definitely not a non-Indian doing the same.
Exactly. And that's the very second important point, that we know that just as a white person does not use the N-word, you do not, you make jokes of those within your own community, and you do them the right kind of way. So that, for example, if women, as Margaret Cho did, says that she doesn't want to be called gay or heterosexual, she just wants to be called a slut. Well, she's calling herself a slut. And when she does that, she's reappropriating that term and giving a positive spin on it. So it becomes no longer a term used by those to degrade women, but instead a term where that what was associated with shame now becomes understood differently, associated with even a kind of pride and a kind of joy. But it's very important exactly who is using the words that are epithets often used as insults. Who is using them, and what kind of context? And if we don't understand that context, we don't understand the force of the joke.
What are the challenges that comics like Margaret Cho or Wanda Sykes have faced in just, you know, getting to the place where they have gotten to? I imagine that they've had to claw their way to the places that they are now, because, you know, we've been told over and over again, women aren't funny, and women of color, we know, have a much higher bar to meet in order to even get the meetings with, you know, Hollywood executives to get your own comedy special, for example.
Yes, that's right. So Margaret Cho, for example, talks about how she was invited originally in Hollywood to play the standard stereotypical roles of Asian women. I mean, roles like being a prostitute, how hard it was to work out of that. And then when you're on the comic stage has been traditionally male terrain. So when women are there at all, they're there as an object of the joke, not the subject, someone who is actually the agent making the joke. And to make that shift is very difficult to do. And it does require not just a very skilled kind of humor, but it also requires having a right kind of audience, including an audience that is ready to support you. This is a kind of audience that critics, like Tig Notaro has talked about this, how critics, comics, that is, need audiences there, that so that when they open themselves up and to connect with the audience, they feel that vibe coming back.
We have been told, especially those people who are progressive, who are feminist, who have used humor as a tool to expose power, are often dismissed as liberal snowflakes by conservatives. And yet, of course, when comics do address power, it's often conservatives who shy away from it, who get very angry about and who have a huge pushback against comics of color and feminist comics in their analysis. And sometimes, you know, sometimes maybe people do push the line too far. I remember Kathy Griffin's perhaps mistaken approach to holding a bloodied Trump head in her hand. And of course, the right wing media went crazy about that. Anytime anyone has ever mentioned, you know, one of Trump's children, people on the left are dismissed as being unfair. So how to tiptoe around the feelings of the powerful?
That is difficult. I mean, you know, we have to go back a bit and think about how, you know, speaking of the powerful, remember the history, for example, of lynching in our country. And lynching could happen if a black man just said one word that was a little off to a white. So words have carried tremendous weight, and usually when insults are perceived as threats to, say, white power or to male power, then those threats are perceived as real harms. Whereas when humor is turned the other way towards those that are not in positions of power, to the socially marginalized, it's often perceived to be just a joke. Why can't you take the joke? Why are you so sensitive? So remember that power is something that is very visible to those who are victims of it. And it's not visible, as visible to those who are abusing power. But it's very easy for comedians to expose all of this too. And in fact, Hannah Gadsby and her Nanette, her special Nanette, she does a great job of doing exactly that, when at one point she starts mocking the men in the audience and she asks them how they like that being turned into a subcategory. And then she plays on that a bit and says things like, it's just a joke. Can't you take a joke? But the idea is to show the men in this case, in her audience, that humor is a powerful force, and its force of insult can be as harmful as, well, as they say, sticks and stones.
Right. And then conversely, of course, the right wing has dismissed the notion of political correctness as being a barrier to their right to have free humor at the expense of the rest of us, to freely express their humor at the expense of the rest of us. How do you view that angle? This was something that Donald Trump, you know, partly campaigned on when he was running for president, the left and its political correctness. We need to do away with that, et cetera.
Well, in this country, we don't have laws such as hate laws that limit free speech in that kind of way. But we all understand, we all know that speech is not to be used to harm others. And there are laws against libel and slander, for example. So the question is, when does speech harm others? And in the case of humor as a type of speech, when does insult fuel hatred? And when does it, on the contrary, work against hatred towards a more inclusive society? And there we're really on contested political terrain, because it's very easy for us to, on one hand, agree with a lot of comics who said that it's important to punch up rather than down. If you talk to a Trump supporter, those who are laughing with him when he turned the debate stage with, for example, Hillary Clinton into a comic stage, they will argue that, well, Hillary Clinton represents the elite and that she needed to be taken down a notch. So it's all about power moves. And the question is, what kind of, how should power be distributed? What kind of ultimate goals in society should we have?
There's the issue of the content of feminist comics, etc. But then there's also representation, right? How critically important is it for young people to see folks that look like themselves up on the stage with the confidence that it requires to do comedy and be, you know, and gain exposure to wide audiences?
Very important, and for one especially interesting reason, and that is the way in which having a sense of humor has been a marker of inclusion in our society since at least the Depression, the 1930s. Sometime around then, there was a cultural shift, and humor was valued. It was an important trait of our personalities. So the question of who is allowed to laugh, who is allowed to make a joke, who is allowed to be seen as funny, is akin to the question of who is allowed to be included among us in the community.
Right.
So, you could, for example, FDR, it was important for FDR to use humor, as it has for our president since him, to use humor in various ways to show that they're one of us.
Finally, we also have, not just with the spread of streaming services like Netflix that have given more platforms for women comedians of color, we also have TV shows like The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel that have showcased the fact that, you know, in the 50s, there were attempts by women comics to be taken seriously, and this show being quite contemporary and quite popular now. Do you think it's also changed the landscape of how women comics might be thought of?
Yeah, it's important for women comics who are now recognized as a strong force to realize that they do have this history. It's a history that hasn't been talked much about. It's been assumed that, for example, women, you know, originally that women didn't have a sense of humor, only men did. And then that was changed to like, maybe women do, but feminists don't. But to realize that, no, women were practicing that art of comedy. And as you say, in the 50s, and often in either radical ways or in highly skilled ways. So to see that hidden history is to understand that women have been always part of producing that dimension of culture.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Cynthia. Good luck with the book.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the interview.
My guest has been Cynthia Willett. She is the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Philosophy at Emory University. And we've been discussing the book that she co-wrote with Julie Willett called Uproarious, How Feminists and Other Subversive Comics Speak Truth. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the Magical Music Petting Zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
K Cebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Dosed movie screening on Saturday, February 1st at 3:30 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Dosed is a documentary about a young lady who uses psychedelic therapy to overcome her addiction to heroin. After the show, there will be a panel discussion featuring members of the cast and production. They will be taking questions from the audience. Again, that's the Dosed movie screening on Saturday, February 1st at 3:30 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Friday, January 24th, 2020. Today marks the fifth day of the trial of President Trump in the U.S. Senate. Today, the impeachment managers led by top House Democrats are concluding their 24 hours of opening statements. For the first time in history, witnesses are being prevented from testifying at an impeachment trial. Also, for the first time in history, the president, who is on trial, is refusing